Yeah, Frank here has got his own billiard room.
Yes, it's what do you call it, Kramer?
Billiard room.
No, not billiard. Not the billiards. It was...
Billiards room.
Come on already. Come on. We call it the...
The place to be.
The place to be. Yes, the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color.
The Grandy Man can.
Time to play the game!
Well, you always left me satisfied and smiling, so...
That's what she said!
Why do I want this? I want to make bank, bro. I want to get ass. I want to drive a Range Rover.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, it is now time for the Place to Be podcast. And now your hosts, Justin Rosero and Scott Criscolo.
Very nice, Mr. Criscolo. In the studio, you don't want to violate, nigga, really and truly, yo. My main thug, nigga, named Julio, he moody, yo. Type of nigga that'll slap you with the tulio. Bitch, nigga, scared to death, act fruity, yo. Fuck that, look at shorty, she a little cutie, yo. The way she shake it make me want to get all in the booty, yo. Top mistress at the banging bitches and videos. While I'm with my freak like we up in the freak shows. Hit you with this shit, make you feel it all in your toes.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, and tonight we delve way, way, way into the back of the vintage vault because we are going to travel way back in time to the mid-80s. That is right, we're taking a brief detour as we come off the Hershey Highway to Hell and we head back through WWF history. And of course, I cannot do that alone, so I must bring on with me, as always, my PIC, Scott Criscolo. Scott, how you doing?
You realize how much shit I had to move in the back of the vault to get this file.
We had to get the something like the old reel.
Yeah. We had to get the one inch tape. So JR, always a pleasure, my friend. Welcome everyone to number 116 of the Place to Be podcast. Indeed, we are going into the vortex, the DeLorean, if you will, called V Squared, the Vintage Vault, and tonight.
Hey, what is going on here?
Oh, I didn't even know you were in there. Your show wasn't even on when this show happened. You were probably like in Broadway or some theater or something, but I didn't even know you were in there. Oh, you're hiding back there. Move that stuff. You realize how much it took me to move that to get the, I had to bring in a 4x15
by 8x10 truck.
By 8x10, hashtag too many wheels. Anyway, tonight we go way back through time, because tonight is the birth of the madness.
Tonight's review is dedicated to Michael Schutz Vincent.
The World Wrestling Federation presents WrestleVision. From the Rosemont Horizon in Chicago, Illinois, it's the Wrestling Classic. Tonight, a 16-man elimination tournament featuring Ricky Steamboat, Adrian Adonis, Tito Santana, Cowboy Bob Orton, Ivan Putski, Randy Savage, The Junkyard Dog, Terry Funk, Paul Orndorff, Moondog Spot, Corporal Kirchner, The Magnificent Morocco, The British Bulldogs, Davey Boy Smith, and The Dynamite Kid, Nikolai Volkov, and The Iron Sheik. In addition, the announcement of the winner of the Rolls-Royce Silver Cloud 3. Plus, in the main event, a world heavyweight title bout, Rowdy Roddy Piper challenges the champion Hulk Hogan, and now Vince McMahon.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the beautiful Rosemont Horizon in the suburbs of the Windy City, Chicago. We are looking forward, indeed, as was outlined earlier, to the 16-man elimination tournament, a most spectacular one-of-a-kind happening in the World Wrestling Federation. Notwithstanding that, also, of course, we'll announce tonight the winner of the Rolls-Royce Silver Cloud 3, and then from there, Hulk Hogan in his title defense against Rowdy Roddy Piper. With me at this moment, my colleague, indeed, Lord Alfred Hayes, along with Susan Waitkus, and here we have this extraordinary tournament lineup. The drawing was held this afternoon, and a most interesting one indeed it was, and Mean Gene Okerlund was on hand, and I would suspect that the conditioning of these athletes, Lord Alfred Hayes, is really going to be tested here tonight as never before.
Well, we know that the wrestlers are the finest conditioned athletes in the world, but this is going to be a magnificent test for them. You can take the decathlon, you can take the marathon, the triathlon, roll them all into one, and they're still going to need more endurance than that. This is the ultimate test, not only of courage, not only of physical endurance, but of mental test also.
All right, then.
That open sounded like the RSV Awards. The saxophone music going in.
Mountain Frost!
And Gold Dust!
By the way, you know what that theme, you know what that music was playing when he was doing the You know what that was, by the way?
What?
That was the music theme to Back to the Future. Thus, the reason why I said DeLorean.
Well, there
that was
you
not
go.
An accident. That was not an accident. Usually, my segues are accidents, but that one actually I remembered on purpose. Tonight, folks, on the Vintage Vault PTB Nation, we give you, yes, finally, the wrestling classic.
You have been clamoring for it. You have been asking for it. You have been begging for it for years and years. People have asked us, "Why don't you do the wrestling classic? Why don't you do the wrestling classic?" So a few months ago, our buddy Michael Vincent asked if we would please do this. In response, he sent us some shoot interviews that he wanted us to listen to. And he just asked for the payment. The only payment he requested was that we review the show for him. So we did a written review that is up on the Bigelow34.proboards.com message board. And now we are delivering this podcast before we head back into 1996, back on the usual track that we're on.
Talk about night and day. Good God. Well, maybe not.
Will you stop?
Sorry, Gorilla. It's good to have you back tonight, my friend.
Mm-hmm.
It's good to have you back, boss. November 7th, 1985.
I always forget it was that late in the year. I always think it was like in like September, August or September or something.
November 7th, yeah. Maybe this was kind of the – well, he wouldn't do the Survivor Series for another 2 years, but I don't know. Maybe it was his thought that it would be a good time of the year to do it. But live from the – I guess it's more like the satellite office.
Yes.
For Vincent Kennedy McMahon. Obviously, the home office was Madison Square Garden, but his satellite office in the Midwest was the Rosemont Horizon in the suburb of Rosemont, Illinois, but we pretty much say Chicago. Even back then, now we used to always talk in the mid-90s about how Vince never went to the United Center. He didn't even go to Chicago Stadium back in the day.
No.
He went to Rosemont. He must have had a deal.
Beautiful Rosemont, as he said.
Yes, beautiful Rosemont, which I know people that live in that part, and Rosemont is far from beautiful. Maybe it was nice in the mid-80s. It's not very nice now. But again, in suburban Chicago. Your attendance, 14,000. And this is officially – now, there was a big debate. Do you remember, JR, when you and I first posted WrestleMania 1 on our message board way back in the day,
mm-hmm.
and people were griping with us because we technically said that was the first pay-per-view?
Right.
This is – officially, and I'm doing my little quotes with my fingers, officially the first WWF pay-per-view.
Mm-hmm.
WrestleMania 1 was half pay-per-view, or kind of like a quarter pay-per-view and three quarters closed circuit. But there were certain cable companies around the country that could purchase WrestleMania 1. So it's technically one, but this is the first one where you really only could buy it.
Right.
I don't think they did closed circuit.
Well, they probably did a few because, I mean, they were just still doing closed circuit through, like, what, WrestleMania 3 or so.
Yeah.
They might. So I'm sure they were. I'm sure it was available closed circuit.
Yeah. I don't remember if my home office, the New Haven Coliseum, had it. They might have. I didn't watch this show live. The tape came out, like, I don't know, a couple months later. And your announcers, you heard one of them, and it's good to have them back for one night. It's like, you know, like those Raw old schools, like the one night return. And JR and I pretty much officially voted it the greatest play-by-play guy of all time, the great Gorilla Monsoon. And, of course, pretty much, I guess to this day, the greatest color commentator of all time. And that is, of course, Jesse the Body Ventura. And Jesse's very active in this show.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Very active.
Yeah, he plays a big role in we'll talk about it as we go, but in one of the men's run. Now, did you enter the giveaway for the Rolls-Royce?
My brother did. I think I was too young.
Yeah, right, okay.
I think I'd be at least...
Sure you were.
Could you imagine that car insurance? Good God. 10 years later, he gives away a house. 10 years before, he gives away a fucking... He gives away a luxury car. What was Vince thinking?
That's probably one of his.
Yeah, most likely. Yes, so in case you're not sure what JR and I are referencing, the WWF actually gave away a Rolls Royce that night.
Right, yeah, that was the hook to get people to that was the hook watch to get the people. Show.
Right. So the whole concept... was a 16-man, as you heard in the open, a 16-man tournament wrapped around a much-anticipated World Wrestling Federation championship match between your champion, Hulk Hogan, and the Hot Rod, not the Hot Scott, Kieran Pollan, but the Hot Rod, Roddy Piper. The only bad thing – now, people always wonder what took us so long.
Mm-hmm.
When you get through this show, you'll understand why, but we, being the pretty good writers we are. Not to toot our own horn, but we are. I'd say after all this time, we are pretty good at writing these. We found a good way to at least try to entertain you while you read it, because the matches alone. Like, I feel bad for the internet writers who go play by play because it's like watching paint dry, trying to play by play this show.
Yeah, exactly. We're not play by play guys. Our main focus is fun facts, you know, history and storylines, and the show just didn't have a lot of that.
So that's why we always avoided it. But once we went back and did it, I mean, there are a lot of guys on here debuting, and we were able to, you know, kind of tell there were some storylines woven throughout the show. So I actually had a little bit more meat than I expected going in. I had only seen, before we watched this last month, I had only seen this like one time, and that was, I was probably like 11 or 12 when I rented the tape and watched it. So I'd maybe seen like bits and pieces of it since then, but not really. I never sat and watched the whole show since then. So it had been a good probably 18 years since I'd seen it. So I looked forward to it and I enjoyed watching it, and I can't say it was the, you know, the best show ever, but let's delve in and we'll see as we go along.
Yes, you're gonna see one thing I do like about this show is you see a lot of very interesting matchups and pretty good personalities, but guys that you really didn't think about at the time, and you know, we're still in the very early stages of the pay-per-view era, so it's a lot of guys that you wouldn't really think about. All right. 16 guys, obviously 8 first round matches, so let's delve right in. Our first match pits a former co-holder of the tag team titles against a newcomer to the scene. That is, of course, Adrian Adonis in the pre-adorable days, taking on Corporal Kirshner. Why don't you give the corporal's background and I'll give the adorable one's background. Tell us about our corporal from, I don't even know where the heck, where did they used to say he was from? Where'd they say he was from? I don't even remember. They didn't say Paris Island. That was Sarge.
No, yeah, that was Sarge.
Yeah, it was somebody else. Anyway.
Well, let's see. He was actually from Chicago. Billed from Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
That's what it was, Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Okay.
All right, well, Mike Kirshner actually had a legit stint in the U.S. military and made his pro debut in 1980. He would join the WWF as an enhancement wrestler, but was given a gimmick overhaul and a push after Vince McMahon realized he had a legitimate military past. Couple that with the fact that their military cash cow, Sergeant Slaughter, had left for the AWA, and they needed someone to fill the void. So the first Corporal Kirshner vignette aired on August 3rd, and he would make his debut as the character on 8/18. So he had only been around about 2 months heading into the show. And I actually saw a funny quip by, I think it was actually Scott Keats said, of all the levels of military, why did they pick corporal? Like, they could have given him, like, a, you know, admiral or what is it, some
general,
higher chief.
General, major, anything. Something with a little teeth. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you know, something a little bit higher than corporal.
His opponent, real name Keith Frank, and he made his pro debut back in 1974. He had eventually adopted the ring name of Adrian Adonis and a biker gimmick later in the decade. Around the same time, he hooked up with Vern Gagne in the AWA, where he formed an unbelievably great tag team with our play-by-play, our color commentator, Jesse the Body Ventura. They were the East-West Connection, New York, San Diego, of course, San Diego. They would have a year-long reign as tag team champions. They had a great feud with the High Flyers, which was Greg Gagne and Jim Brunzel, throughout 77, 78, 79, 80. And in late 81, they left the AWA, probably because they felt like they were getting stiffed on money, which is usually the reasons why people left Vern, and joined the World Wrestling Federation. They had a good tag team run. They also wrestled in singles competition. But then, for those that that already know or don't know, Jesse the Body had to retire with a blood clot issue in his lungs. So he had to retire. So Adrian Adonis hooked up with another tag team partner, Dirty Dick Murdoch, or the Redneck Outlaw, or he had like 50 million nicknames depending on what promotion he was in. And on April 17th, 1984, they defeated, I believe it was Rocky Johnson and Tony Atlas, I believe, to become the World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions. They would hold those titles until January of 85, when they would lose to my first favorite tag team as a kid, the U.S. Express, Barry Windham, Mike Rotundo. Then after that, they broke up. Dick Murdoch left. I think he went back to Mid-Atlantic.
Yeah, they defeated Atlas and Johnson.
Yeah, it was Atlas and Johnson. They broke up, and Murdoch, I think, went back to Mid-Atlantic. And Adrian Adonis stayed here and kind of meandered around the mid-card. In fact, I think he hooked up – I think he was one of Bobby the Brain's first guys.
Yes.
When Bobby first arrived from the AWA. And then that was very briefly, and then he jumped with the Mouth of the South, Jimmy Hart. At the time.
What the hell is this shit? Red chocolate or something off.
I think he was in Mid-Atlantic at the time, too. Probably sleeping under the ring.
I think Adrian Adonis ate too much of the chocolate that was on his jacket.
Yeah, no kidding. He didn't look that bad.
He was definitely bigger than he had been during the teaming with Murdoch. And Gorilla actually even mentions it here, saying he looked like he bulked up for the match. But, you know, I was always a big Adonis fan. For a big guy, he bumped and sold so tremendously. What an he's just such an underrated worker. And he even works a pretty smart match here. You know, he tries to, you know, ground Kirchner. And he has some pretty good offense for the time period. You know, nice back suplex he works in. And then he finishes him with a DDT, which is pretty interesting, too.
Good DDT, too. Stiff.
Yeah. So, I mean, he just his bumping was so good in his facials. And, I liked Adonis. And it was right after this is where he started to kind of change his persona a little bit. But this is like in between the biker and what he would become. And, you know, I liked him here. He you know, beats Kircher in an okay match, just some 2.5 minutes, something special. But, yeah, I was always an Adonis fan. Well, like super gross weight gain, but
when he really got plump. Incidentally, I mentioned on our written reviews. And by the way, follow along with us, Bigelow34.proboards.com. Incidentally, I mentioned in my comments that I thought you'd get excited that Adrian had the Yankee logo on his boots. But if you look up close, it's not the exact. It's just NY. Although it looks like it from a distance because he did have navy blue boots with the white NY. So I guess maybe he's like one of those knockoff hats you see in the stores in Manhattan. It's kind of like knockoff boots. The match itself is not that great. It's only 2.5 minutes. Get used to those durations as we go through this show. And, you know, Adonis wins. I mean, kind of weird, though, that here's a guy who's been here only a couple months, and he's like this up-and-coming face, and they have him lose. Kind of weird.
Yeah, that is weird.
You know, very strange. So Adrian Adonis moves on to the next round.
Although Adonis was still getting a decent push, and they obviously had some pretty interesting things planned for him in 86. And honestly, I think a lot of the show is predicated around matchups, you know, so.
Yeah, exactly.
It's fine. I don't think Kircher was ever really set for too big of a push. I mean, I think he was going to get a decent push, but I don't.
Right. I mean, he didn't have that. I mean, let's just be honest. He just didn't have that charisma like the Sarge had. Right. You know, the Sarge had everybody in the palm of his hand, and that was probably the one coup that I think Vern had in the mid-80s off Vince as he was able to get. And Corporal actually had a pretty – or Corporal. The Sarge actually had a pretty decent run in AWA those
right.
few
well,
years.
Well, his deal was that didn't Vince want a piece of his G.I. Joe pie?
Yes.
And he didn't want to give it up.
And he want to give it up. So he goes to AWA where Vern tries to put his hand in your pocket every 10 seconds?
Yeah, well, Vern didn't give a shit what they did outside the ring, though. Remember, that was a whole deal with Hogan, too. He left back in 83 or 82, whatever it was, because he wanted to do Rocky III and Vince didn't want him to do it. Or Vince's dad, whichever one it was, didn't want
Vince's
him.
Dad.
Yeah, they didn't want him to do it. So, you know, Vern was like, I don't give a shit and do what you want. So I think that was a big part of it with Slaughter. I think he, you know, wanted to keep the G.I. Joe stuff going, so.
But I'm surprised because at the time, I don't know, like maybe by 84, Vern wasn't really hemorrhaging money yet. That probably wasn't until like 87 or 88. But anyway. All right. So there you go. Adrian Adonis moves on to the quarterfinals where he'll take on the winner of this match between one half of a real up-and-coming tag team against one half of a former tag team champions.
Actually, here, let me read a little bit with Slaughter here. Mm-hmm. With the emergence of Hulk Hogan as WWF champion, the lead face within the company, Slaughter left for the AWA. On Vince McMahon's McMahon DVD, Slaughter said he was fired by McMahon in Toronto after no-showing an event in protest of McMahon's refusal to give him 6 weeks paid vacation. Other interviews with Slaughter and McMahon have revealed that Slaughter left the company more of the dispute that emerged due to WWF not allowing Slaughter's role in the G.I. Joe toy line. At the time of Slaughter's departure, he was easily the second biggest face in the company. And that makes sense because they had their own toys out and they probably didn't want, you know, competing toys of Slaughter out there. So
right. No, it makes sense. It makes sense. Yeah, I believe that over the 6 weeks I mean, gets paid vacation and, well... I mean, back then, I mean, now the contracts are different, but I bet you back then nobody got, you know, nothing was guaranteed. You probably, I mean, you know, during the promotion years, you know, the territory years, you know, you didn't have guys signed for long-term. You know, probably worked on a per diem basis, most likely. So, in any event, our next match, as I mentioned, pitting two guys who were really up and coming in the tag team ranks. Well, mm-hmm. One is up and coming, one started to fizzle. Nikolai Volkoff, who, of course, earlier in the year at the first WrestleMania with his cohort, the Iron Sheik, defeated my beloved U.S. Express to win the tag team championships. U.S. Express would get them back, I don't know, a couple months later, like June, I think they won it back.
Yeah.
Yeah, June they won it back. Taking on one of the true studs in terms of work rate around the world at this time, and that is, of course, one half of the British Bulldogs, the Dynamite Kid. Dynamite Kid, real name Tom Billington. Made his debut in Britain in 1975, obviously he's British, brought over to Calgary in 78 by Bruce Hart, was instrumental in the training of Bruce's little brother, Brett. Following a stint with Stampede, Dynamite wrestled in Japan from 1980 to 84, and that's where a lot of his real cred came from. Wrestled a boatload of of unbelievable guys, including the original Tiger Mask.
Mm-hmm.
Dynamite made his WWF debut in late August of 1984, teaming with Brett to defeat Iron Mike Sharp and Troy Alexander. What a team, huh? Dynamite, Brett. Wow.
Oh, I think Sharp and Troy Alexander.
Yeah, that stud Troy Alexander. Hey, anybody would be lucky to have Iron Mike Sharp as their partner. Yes. But no, I mean like Dynamite and Brett.
Oh, yeah, team, huh? Yeah, obviously, yeah. Tremendous.
Wow. Once he joined the WWF, he continued to also team with his cousin, Davey Boy Smith.
And of course, Brett.
Yes. Davey Boy, of course, would end up, Brett would end up hooking up with the Anvil to have mm-hmm. their own tag team. And obviously, both these guys being British made more sense. So the British Bulldogs. And we already talked about Nikolai at WrestleMania 1.
Right. And not, you know me, big Russian fan. Love me some Nikolai. This match is nothing. 6 seconds. Nikolai sings the national anthem. Dynamite climbs up the top, hits him with a missile drop kick, and pins him. And that's it. He advances. So very sad to see the Russian go down. But Dynamite moving on, setting up a pretty interesting match with Adonis in the second round was good to see. And, God, even though it's only one quick move, just the quickness that Dynamite just leaps up to the top and flies off with the drop kick, like, just showed you just a glimpse of just how great he was.
Yeah. Incidentally, on another quick note, I meant to mention this in the beginning. The copy you have, what copy is it again? Did you dub mine, right? Is this the one that you dubbed that of mine? Or did somebody?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it was.
Yeah. The copy I got off of eBay, I wanted to just comment briefly on. I loved the old school Coliseum video opens with the
yes,
and they had like the old pictures of like guys wrestling in like 1920, yep. and then all the cool shots. Johnny Rods getting the elbow from Hogan. It's just so awesome. Those old school opens. I love those. Anyway, so there you go. Dynamite Kid moves on and will take on Adrian Adonis in the quarterfinals, which really contrasts in styles, but could end up being a pretty good match. All right, this is a big one.
Mm-hmm.
Big match coming up next. We have an old school grizzled WWF Hall of Famer against a shining light in the future of the company. I'll leave the him to you. I'll take care of the older guy. Figures.
Yeah. All right, well, all Randy right. Macho Man Savage, of course, needs no introduction to wrestling fans. He made his much anticipated WWF debut in the fall of 1985. He was actually a former minor league baseball player. Before getting to wrestling, cut his teeth in Memphis with his father, Angelo Poffo, in a renegade promotion that the family ran. He wrestled mainly as a heel, but had a little bit of a face run as well. And this is a pretty big outlaw promotion they had, feuding with Jerry Lawler and Jerry Jarrett's Mid-South wrestling in Memphis. And it was almost like pre-Monday Night War / NWO thing they had going on, where they would like basically like show up at Mid-South shows and you know, start shit, and they just trash Mid-South all over their shows, and they really were out for like straight up competition. Eventually though, they would actually merge, and Savage and his brother Lanny would go to Mid-South, and they would do a feud, you know, almost like NWO WCW, where they joined, they were part of the promotion but feuding with them to make it seem like it was a real feud.
Right.
Obviously, his feud with Jerry Lawler was very well documented in 1984. Had the memorable steel cage match where the chicken coop wire and all that.
Yeah.
And they had the pile driver through the table as well, right? Wasn't that
show? Yep.
Or that match, rather. He would jump to New York eventually, and after watching all of the WWF managers vie for him week after week, he introduced the world to his valet, of course, the beautiful Miss Elizabeth, who was his real-life wife.
Yeah. I loved watching that back then. That was right. Yeah. You know, I've been watching for a couple of years at that point, but this was like the first really cool storyline stuff that went down, and you know, all the managers, and every week there'd be new, you know, new builds, and you know, every week they'd have a different vignette with like Johnny Valiant and Jimmy Hart and Bobby and
he was all over TNT during this run too. If you watch those old TNTs, he was on there quite a bit.
Yes, he had some of the more you would have thought he got the Adrian Adonis gimmick, because he had some of the most unusual spandex outfits I think that I've ever seen. But we all knew. I mean, you knew the minute you saw the guy that he was a star. There's just no doubt about
it. He's the first guy he enters here. He's got music. He's got a look. I mean, he just had a star look just walking out to the ring here, and you could just tell. And right off the bat, just the presence he had, he just really stood out. And he's just so fast at this show, so quick, and just moving around, you know, with such great agility, and just worked his ass off. And well, why don't you give the background of his opponent, and then we'll gush some more about Randy Savage.
We'll gush more about him in a minute. So his opponent, a WWF Hall of Famer and still a guy in pretty good shape, his name was Josef Bednarski. No, that's not his, that was his real name. But he was a Polish immigrant, migrated to Texas at a young age, eventually joined the pro wrestling circuit in 1968 as the name he would eventually take, Ivan Putski.
Do you remember his debut, watching it live?
I did. I was.
Who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Exactly. Who are you to doubt Joseph Bednarski? Putski would work across the Midwest, Texas, and eventually in the AWA, using various gimmicks, including runs as a lucky dimwit and a and a concentration camp survivor. What? Who the hell came up with that? Along the way, he would sign on with Vince McMahon's WWWF in 1974. Would become embroiled in memorable feuds. Him and Bruiser Brody had a great brawl at the Garden. I think it might be on one of our house shows.
How come I didn't come up with that idea of a concentration camp survivor?
Again, Bruiser Brody fought Ivan Koloff. Maybe he thought it was stupid. Who knows? And Stanley and Hansen, those two guys used to freaking bludgeon each other.
Yep.
Yeah, some of, I think some of the older house shows you and I have in our collection, I think, have a couple of his better matches. In October of 79, he teamed with Tito Santana, very young Tito
Odd
Santana.
Team.
Yeah, I know, really. To win the tag team titles. I remember who they beat. Late 70s. Probably the Samoans, I would think.
Yeah, anyone who won the titles at that point beat the Samoans. I'll try and find out, though.
Yeah. He'd bounce around the country, still competed with the WWF, but would show up kind of in other places.
Actually, they beat the Valiants, and then they lost to the Samoans.
Okay. And as the 80s rolled on, he would become more of a, you know, kind of a, not a nostalgia star, but like a specialty star for special.
He basically became a jobber to the stars. And that's what Vince did with a lot of these guys. You know, he kept his dad's guys around out of loyalty, but he would use them to put over all the new guys he brought in, like Randy Savage and some of the guys we'll see later. You know, a lot of these imports. And then he'd use Putski and there's a couple other guys I'm trying, the Gurria, you know, guys like that who had been not major stars, but pretty decently high up on the card in the early 80s, and he would use them to put these guys over, which was, you know, a pretty shrewd move, I thought.
Yeah, and it was also kind of a loyalty thing. You know, one, obviously at this point, Vince's father passed away, and he, you know, he was a loyalty guy, and I think that's where Vince's loyalty still, I mean, he may not seem it at times, but that he got from his dad. Obviously, we always talk about the fact that He was told he had to give three guys jobs, and that was Pat, Arnie Skolin, and Gorilla. Mm-hmm. But I think these other guys, the Putskis and all these guys that wrestled for his dad in the 70s that, you know, were getting older, but, you know, Vince was going to, you know, let
him
work.
Even Pedro Morales he would use as basically a job to the stars over these couple of years as well.
Yeah, exactly. But the guys still put on good matches. You know, yeah. they weren't fat slobs or anything.
No, right? Exactly. They were used in early, you know, early house show matches, and you know, even Rocky Johnson, another guy that kind of hangs around, and now, I want to say they're jobber to the stars. That's probably the wrong, you know, misnomer. But they were guys. I guess they are. They were guys who would beat jobbers on TV and house shows to keep their names alive. And then, you know, they were used to put over these guys coming into the promotion.
Yeah. But, I mean, they would be good matches. I mean, you know, Pedro would fight like
Yeah, they were competitive matches.
But they'd be like 15-minute matches. They wouldn't be like two-minute squashes.
Exactly. No. When I say jobber to the stars, that's what I mean. Guys who beat the true jobbers, but they hang in there with the legitimate stars. But they never beat, you know, like you never see Putski beat Randy Savage. So
no, never.
And Savage, to me, of all these guys they brought in, and then there was a ton of talent that they imported, but Savage, to me, was the guy you could just look at and see he had all the tools to just be a megastar. And, you know, they would obviously give him the opportunity here. And, of course, my favorite storyline running throughout the show is Jesse Ventura in the commentary booth, just supporting Savage the whole way, backing him and saying how he helped train him for the tournament and all the work they put in for this opening match. You know, he just really, really put him over throughout the match. And to me, that ends up being the best running storyline throughout the tournament.
Yes, I agree completely. And but Jesse was one of those guys who you could, you know, you can get angry at, but at the same time, you know, he wasn't stupid about it, and he just, you know, he really put, as much as he was agitating you, which was what his job was as a heel, he was putting over Savage big time. And Gorilla, this is the best thing I like about Gorilla, he wasn't not putting Savage over as a superstar. Obviously, he was an unchivalrous, you know, cad when it came to Elizabeth, but he, you know, in the ring, no one could deny the guy was going to be a stud.
Oh, I know. What an interesting concept. I'm not burying your fucking talent and putting him over, making him look strong and effective.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, why don't you pull they should pull the handbook out now, the guys that are on now. But anyway, this match is, you know, it's quick, just under 3 minutes. Savage wins, obviously, with rolls him up. I think he pulls the tights, most likely. I don't remember if he does or not, but I wouldn't be surprised if he did. And, you know, just a quick nothing match, you know. couple of, you know, Putski gets his little hammer in, Polish hammer in, but for the most part, you knew Savage was going to win this match. I don't think there's any doubt about it. But, you know, Putski got a payday out of it, and that was, you know, that was pretty good. But yeah, immediately, right from the minute he walked down the ramp, you knew the aisle, you knew this guy was a superstar.
Oh, yeah.
Even from that first match, if you have the Savage DVD, if you don't have it, get it. There's nothing else to say. Just get it. The first match when he had with the late great Quick Draw Rick McGraw at the Garden, even there, never saw the guy before. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of fans back then. He's upper, you know, the territorial New York.
Right, yeah, they wouldn't
never
have seen
saw
him.
The guy before. Yeah. Immediately, even there, people are like, "Mike, wow, this guy's a jack off,"
he's
quick. A star.
Just so quick in the ring.
But he's a star. So Savage moves on. Time to possess, just waiting to get by. Is that a part? I didn't catch that part. What song that was? Maybe that's a part you don't play a lot.
That's from WrestleMania. The album. No, I'm not kidding.
Oh, good lord, Jesus. Haven't we covered every cut on that at this point? Lord.
That'd be quite the track if they had that in there.
Yeah. All right. So the Macho Man sits back and takes on the winner of this match. Highly anticipated. What did Vince say? Highly competitive matchup.
Yes,
right
highly competitive matchup.
Highly competitive matchup right here. Featuring the other half of the British Bulldogs, a.k.a. Davey Boy Smith, taking on another import from Mid-Atlantic. And we don't have to give his background. We gave it at WrestleMania 1. But why don't you give us the background on the Dynamite Kid's tag partner?
Well, Davey Boy Smith got started in Britain at the age of 15. In 1978, he debuted and won a match against Bernie Wright. I believe he was one of your childhood idols, Bernie Wright.
Yes.
Despite some resistance from his cousin, the Dynamite Kid, Smith finally made his way over to Calgary around the same time Dynamite did, and both men would feud over the Stampede British Commonwealth title in 1982. Smith would follow his cousin to Japan for a brief stint before arriving in the WWF in 1984 along with Dynamite. And they had quite the weird relationship. And Dynamite kind of looked down at him a little bit as this dumb younger cousin that was just kind of trying to tag along. And if you read Dynamite's book, I mean, he's not that complimentary to him. But, you know, he put him over as an in-ring talent, but always saying he was obviously a step behind Dynamite. And he never really wanted him tagging along with him around. But his dad kind of made him take him under his wing. So, you know, he follows him to Canada, follows him to Japan, follows him here. And then, as we've detailed in other podcasts, they had quite the falling out in 1990. So,
yes. But, you know, and I don't understand what Dynamite's problem was. Maybe he just didn't want to be a tag guy, but he was a perfect complement to Dynamite. Dynamite was the quick, fast, you know, expert work rate guy. And Davey Boy was the big, the power guy. You needed to have a guy like that. You couldn't have two little guys, you know, unless you were going to have like a Rockers type tag team, but
right.
Obviously they're making that, or Killer Bees, I guess it would be at that point. But his opponent, again, we don't have to go through his background. We talked about it at WrestleMania 1, and that is, of course, the great Ricky Steamboat. Still wearing his, I believe, still wearing his white NWA tights here.
No, he had the black pants.
Did he have the black on by then?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, he did. You're right. He did. Or maybe they were navy blue, because that was like that kind of where he had the little red, you know, the little red. I don't want to say a scarf, but that belt thing, you know, when he was about to feud with Morocco,
This could have been such a great match if...
Yeah, it really could have.
If it was a normal card and they had more time, and they only get just under 3 minutes, and we get the lame ending. But the match itself, it was a good one while it lasted. They move fast-paced, crisp, stiff, really kind of smack into each other. And it was a unique little strategy Davey Boy was using. He was actually working Steamboat over with a press slam that he kept, like, slamming him with, and I thought it was kind of cool. And Steamboat actually came back with a great delayed suplex.
Yes.
Hoisting Davey up for a while before crashing back to the mat. I really like that. Those two spots really stood out to me. And then just when things were really starting to get cranking, Davey goes for a dive and ends up crotching himself with the ropes and collapses to the mat, writhing in pain, and the referee calls for the bell. So kind of odd. I don't know. Did you ever read if this was legit? I forget.
I don't remember. No, I don't remember how this goes either. I think it was just to make the match short. And then neither guy would have to job.
I mean, looks like a painful spot.
Yeah, I mean he hits his, you know, twig and berries clear into the rope.
Right.
But I don't think that was the way the match was. I think that was the way the match was supposed to end. But this is the first match where I start to realize as the card's progressing, I've never seen the show is only a couple hours. I mean, how long was this show?
Was this a
house show or something? I mean, why do they have to make these matches so damn short? I didn't understand. Mm. You know, like our next match is two matches from now is ridiculously short. But I don't understand why they had to have this many short matches. I don't understand. What were they saving time on? It's not like the Hogan Piper match was going to be 45 minutes or anything. So I don't understand why.
Well, it's like that's how things were back then. Either matches are quick or they were, you know, 20-minute draws.
So, yeah, exactly.
Like no in between.
Yeah, exactly. So the match only 2:53, but clearly these were two guys that could have given you, you know, 9-10 minutes.
Oh, easy. They could have given you a half hour if you gave it to them.
Yeah, really. I mean, they were just so. I mean, Steamboat speaks for himself, and Davey Boy. Yeah, he was young, but you know,
he wasn't the polished, knowledgeable worker he'd be by the mid-90s. But he's, you know, he makes up for it by being, you know, smaller and quicker and more youthful and risk taking here. Than he would be in the 90s. By that point, he was a smarter wrestler. He was, you know, bigger, obviously, but he hadn't really gotten on the gas big time here. He was jacked, you know, he was definitely juicing, but he wasn't over the top like he'd become.
No, not at all. So Steamboat, you know, he doesn't want to win this way. I love the response. Steamboat was so creamy back then as a babyface. When he picked the names out of the hat, he goes, "Oh man, oh, Davey Boy, man, good attitude. He's gonna be tough." That's so ridiculously corny. It was great. So 80s. It was awesome. So the steamer moves on, and he will take on the Macho Man Randy Savage in the next round.
Dream match.
Little did we know. This was the birth of maybe one of the late 80s greatest feuds. So, but nobody knew that at the time. All right, next up, as we go through this ridiculously long first round, one very evil heel taking on one ridiculously over face. Your heel is the other half of the former tag team champions. We saw his partner, Nikolai Volkoff, earlier on. Of course, former World Wrestling Federation champion, the Iron Sheik. Complete with his, I don't know if he had the cool, like half purple Iran tights. I think he had like his little tiny tights. Taking on probably the second most over guy in the company.
Well, I started this dance in my neighborhood. Now everybody's doing it because it feels so good. All you need is a partner.
Yeah. Didn't have the song quite yet by the time when he made his...
But when did the rest of that album come out? Because it was on there.
But he used Another One Bites of Dust here.
You sure?
Yes, because it cut off on my tape. It's, remember, the first Slammies was until 86.
Okay. Well, I knew that. I thought the album came out in 85.
The album did come out in 85, but this wasn't used as his theme until 86. Because he did the same night that Vince did his classic Stand Back.
Well, that was a pile driver, though. Because Stand Back was a pile driver.
So maybe it was 87 then. Oh, you know, I'm thinking 87 because that was that ridiculously bad food fight between Harley Race and Jim Duggan.
Yeah, this was released. It doesn't say the date. This says 19.
Well, it definitely came out in 85 because I remember buying it on tape. But for this show, of course, folks, you're wondering what we're talking about. We're, of course, talking about the Junkyard Dog. But I even mentioned in my comments that his intro's cut off, so it cuts off Another One Bites of Dust. So he's still using Another One Bites of Dust here.
Do you know who the guest vocalist is in the song?
Is it Cyndi Lauper?
No. Disco singer Vicky Sue Robinson.
Oh. Turn the beat around.
Is
wow.
that her?
Yeah, that was her. Yeah. And it's funny, because Cyndi Lauper guest sang on every other WWF song at that point. But
did you know Meatloaf was in the Land of a Thousand Dances video?
Get the fuck out of here. Seriously?
A music video was made for the song featuring Rick Derringer, Meatloaf, and Cyndi Lauper.
Well, he had nothing else to do in the mid-80s. He was pretty much doing nothing but playing softball, so probably needed a quick paycheck. Yeah, he definitely come. He doesn't use this as a theme pay-per-view anyway until WrestleMania 2. Here, he still comes out to Another One Bites the Dust. But this song is on the wrestling album. You're absolutely right. It's actually the second cut right after Land of a Thousand.
Grab them cakes.
Cakes? With the paper crinkling in the back. But anyway, JYD takes on the Iron Sheik in a match that was probably on 5 million house shows that year. Seems like a typical house show or like primetime match between these two guys. And again, a little bit over 3 minutes and, you know, nothing earth shattering. The dog wins with a headbutt.
It was kind of weird too, because the Sheik is like arguing with the referee, and JYD just kind of comes up from behind head. But yeah, the match actually was all right. It wasn't too bad.
Yeah, but yeah, the end was weird. I remember Jesse getting all pissed off. I think that JYD cheated or something.
Yeah, it was something weird like that. And
yeah,
Sheik got the camel clutch, and it wasn't a bad little match. I mean, Sheik, you know, Sheik could go. He was no joke. I mean, he gets made a joke out of now because of how he is, and, you know, at the time when he you know, he jobbed to Hogan and everything, and, you know, he was made to be like a joke, but in the ring, I mean, he could really work. He was no clown in the ring.
No, absolutely not. Well, former Olympian, so he knew his he knew his stuff in the ring.
He was like the original suplex machine.
He was. I mean, he used to do the gut wrench, and he used a lot of different suplexes. More like the leading into other moves, and it wasn't like for finishers, but they were great setups.
Yeah, he had like a lot of gut wrenches and stuff like that.
Yeah. But he does not get the win here, and the JYD moves on to face the winner of this match, which just this makes no sense to me whatsoever. Whatsoever, this match makes no sense.
Bar the door. Fans in the Bay Area, Oakland Coliseum Arena, Wednesday night, January the 2nd, the first big one of 1985. And believe you me, it is going to be a barn burner. Greg the Hammer Valentine to be challenged by Tito Santana for the Intercontinental Championship. As a result of what transpired in that big tag team bout involving Junkyard Dog and the Iron Sheik, needless to say now, it has come down to one-on-one. You, Sheik Lahani, to meet the great black star, the Junkyard Dog.
Mr. Junkyard.
All right, hang on. the great black star.
Did you just say the great black star?
Oh, tremendous. Okay, let's continue.
So there you go. See, what did I tell you? The feud is 11 months old at this
point. I know, huh? I didn't even know that when I picked this clip.
The great
Dog,
black star.
Whatever your name is, I remember last time what we did it to you. You was like dairy black dog on the ring, and all your fans and all the white people and black people in the San Francisco or Oakland, California, everybody call USA, USA. But the honest, intelligent American, honest, intelligent Arabian, Iranian in the Oakland side, what I did that to you. And that people said, Iran, Iran. Now, this time, gonna be completely different. I hope somebody call in the Oakland, California or San Francisco hospital to bring the ambulance over there.
We have hospitals both in San Francisco and Oakland.
That's right. No, you don't have to correct me. I know my English is not good like you, sir. Remember, Junkyard Dog, this time somebody have to go hospital. And then for sure is you, Iran, number one. Allahu Akbar. Ashhadu Allah, 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 Allah. Salam alaikum.
Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum. Wednesday night, the 2nd, Oakland Coliseum. Do not miss it. Police with the flag.
You're like dirty black dog on the side of the road. Oh, that was a find right there, huh?
Oh, that is a tremendous promo. You gotta post that. That was outstanding.
You're like
but
dirty
again,
black dog.
Another thing that gets me depressed, the days of pimping awesome house shows.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, that's dead. Yeah. I don't see that again. But again, I was pretty good. That feud was now 11 months old at this point. Still wrestling dirty black dogs. The great. What do you call them, the great?
Hulk Hogan, we're coming for you, nigga.
Yeah, I mean, she might as well just said that.
The great black star, the Junkyard Dog. You're laying on side of road, you dirty black dog.
That's tremendous.
All the black and white fans. What a fucking disaster.
Oh,
all right, let's
God.
Move along.
Okay.
You go from one dog to another.
Yeah, exactly. This one pisses me off more than anything in this first round. Another newcomer. Not a newcomer, period, but a newcomer to the company. One of the greatest of all time. Taking on pretty much, for doing not even a jobber to the stars, just pretty much a pure jobber. Mm. And we're talking about Moondog Spot, or Spotty, as Gorilla would call him. Taking on a stud in the history of the business. Why don't you talk about our man from the Double Cross Ranch in Amarillo, Texas.
The iconic Terry Funk.
Yes.
Began his career way back in 1965, working for his father's promotion in Amarillo, Texas. In 1975, Terry won the NWA heavyweight title, defeating Jack Briscoe. Reign lasted 14 months, came to a close at the hands of Harley Race. After the loss, he started teaming with his brother, Dory Jr., touring the country in Japan. After building a name for himself overseas, the Funks finally hit the WWF in 1985, picking up Jimmy Hart as a manager on the way in. And of course, this is after Terry's first retirement in 1983.
Yeah.
Came back here, and he takes on the missing link Moondog Spot, who's subbing for the Missing Link. And Moondog Spot was portrayed by Larry Booker, started his career in 1979, settled in Memphis, where he teamed with Wayne Ferris as the Blonde Bombers. You know, Wayne Ferris is a honky-tonk man.
Yes.
Managed by Danny Davis, they competed in the legendary Tupelo concession stand brawl against Jerry Lawler and Bill Dundee. That was the first wild, crazy brawl that went all the way back to the concession area and, you know, got the food fight and everything else.
Tupelo concession. Hit you in the face with a funnel cake.
Well, yeah, they tried to recreate that in WCW later on. Yeah. So after splitting up with Ferris, Latham, I have Larry Booker here, but I think he went under Larry Latham.
Yeah.
For a bit. Resurfaced with a new gimmick as part of a tag team under the name Moondog Spot. The Moondogs would work Memphis for a while before hooking up with the Dirty F as the decade turned. In May of 1981, Spot and teammate Rex actually won the tag team titles from Rick Martel and Tony Garea. The Moondogs would lose the belts but and remain as enhancement talents through the majority of the 80s before heading back to Memphis, where they remained throughout the 90s. So, yeah, pretty much a jobber here, pretty much a joke by this point. And I'm guessing they just didn't want Terry to job legitimately to anyone, and they didn't want him to win, because he was pretty new here, and he's going to be having that feud with Hogan in 86, right?
Yes. So why don't they have him win this match, though? And then he faces Junkyard Dog, and, well, no, then he faces Junkyard Dog, loses by DQ or something, starts beating the crap out of him.
I guess they
could. And then it leads to they end up, yes, he wrestles Hogan, but he ends up, obviously facing Junkyard Dog.
I think maybe,
Dog,
like anything, though, they tried to just make it where... They probably just wanted a shock. Lose. Well, and some shock value. You know what I mean? Like, they probably wanted to mix things up a little bit and have an upset like this. And, I mean, it was entertaining. It's stupid. Obviously, it's a waste of funk. But, right. You know, it's kind of funny and harmless just to see, you know, him trying to trick Spot into getting counted out. And then Spot ends up, you know, running him into the ring post or whatever and slides in the ring and wins by count out.
Yeah, I just, you know, it just seemed like too good a guy to not have in a decent match, but you know, it gets par for the course. So there you go. So Moondog Spot will be taking on
Junkyard Dog
in the next round. Very interesting, weird matchup. Hmm. Two dogs.
Right.
The white dog and the black dog, as as Mean Gene would say.
The great black dog taking on the shitty white dog.
White trash dog.
Didn't surprise me one bit because he's a big, fat, sloppy dog.
Yeah. The last two matches here, finally we get some pretty decent work rate for once.
Well, we had some good matches earlier.
We had some good matches earlier, but these are ones we actually had a little bit of time on.
Well, these are four guys coming up that we know well in the promotion at this point, and we're the studs of the mid-card pretty much.
Yes. Our next match involves your World Wrestling Federation Intercontinental Champion, Tito Santana, who had the belt that would forever be known as the Intercontinental belt, currently, of course, worn by Cody Rhodes, brought it back recently. Of course, they're talking about, I don't know what they actually call it. They say it's the classic belt, but it has like it was almost like the Coliseum belt.
Yeah, it was a globe.
Yeah. And he would take on
the Magnificent Morocco.
Who was not at WrestleMania 1, so we actually have to give his background. I'll take care of it. Because he wasn't at WrestleMania 1, which surprised a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Morocco, a former Hawaii State amateur wrestling champion that jumped into the pro game back in 1970. He trained up and down the Pacific Coast before accepting an offer to join the AWA, where he remained until 1973, which is when he left for San Francisco. A year later, he ventured south to Florida, where his star began to glow a bit brighter. In 1975, he returned to San Francisco, continuing to collect gold along the way. Before we do that, before we go any further, if you have, for those of you who have Dusty Rhodes DVD, the match that's on there with him and Dick Murdoch as the Outlaws, he takes on a team of Billy Robinson and a very young Don Morocco. Let's see, if I'm right, place right my notes here. Okay. It was during this run that he first worked as a heel. In San Francisco, a role that would suit him quite well as his career rolled on. Over the next 4 years, Morocco bounced around from California to Florida to Hawaii, honing his craft. In 1981, Morocco finally headed back north, this time signing on with the WWF. He would defeat Pedro Morales, I believe in September, to win the Intercontinental Championship, which he held for 5 months. He briefly left the promotion for a stint in Mid-Atlantic, returned to New York in late 1982, debuted alongside new manager, still heel Captain Lou Albano. On January 22nd, he defeated Morales again to become the IC champion. This reign would be the one that he is most remembered.
Mm-hmm.
He would have it for over a year and a half after a legendary feud with Jimmy Snuka, which, of course,
Snuka
concluded with the match that pretty much made me a fan, and that was October 17th, 1983 at the Garden. Morocco would begin to develop into a tremendous, arrogant, pompous, disrespectful heel. He was a great heel.
Yeah,
he really was.
Great dick.
He would drop the belt to Tito Santana in February of 84 and would switch managers, this time hooking up with the Nefarious.
And useless.
Mr. Fuji. Morocco and Fuji would deliver a tremendous mix of villainous mischief and campy humor while developing into one of the most memorable duos in WWF history. Do we all remember Fuji Vice?
Of course.
Fuji Medical.
And Morocco would put on some great squash matches during this time as well. Of course, the infamous one where he eat the sandwich in between moves of beating down a jobber. And yeah, he had his tombstone pile driver, which was great. So,
and he went through a stretch where on the prime times, if Gorilla and Bobby were doing matches, he would dedicate the pile driver to Bobby.
Right, yeah, he'd point up.
Bobby, this one's for you.
Yeah.
And then he would drive.
Yeah, very entertaining. Very entertaining worker. And these two had a very good feud. And this is another match that could have went another 15, 20 minutes and really developed to something great. You know, Morocco, usual power assault, strikes. Tito came back a little bit more high-flying, a little bit aggressive in his offense. And I just, you know, Morocco had such a great power offense. And that's what I liked about a lot of the veterans during this time period. You know, you see a lot of pundits and wrestling fans, especially newer fans that don't really get the era, you know, kind of crap on some of these matches for just being kind of long and boring. But you guys had specific move sets that you could really, you know, see working for their style and look. You know, like Morocco, big, thick guy, just worked this great power offense where it just pounded on you and beat you down and, you know, used power moves and power strikes. And then and Tito used, like, a fired-up, aggressive, you know, throw it all out, at the, you know, throw it all out, see what happens kind of attitude. So,
right.
You know, every guy kind of had their little move set that worked for them. So, yeah, I like this match. It's two veterans. So you can't go wrong with these two guys, especially when you just give them 5 minutes. You know they're not going to disappoint.
Right. Considering, you know, technically, you know, the feud was probably still smoldering, even though, you know, had been over a year and a half since Tito beat Morocco for the IC title. Definitely you saw the chemistry between the two. Mm-hmm. And, again, great match.
Well, they did the only thing, the finish was a little weak. They did the dusty finish where the ref counts three, Morocco. It looked like he had him pinned, but Tito puts his foot on the rope, and then Tito jumps up, cradles him, the ref just counts. He doesn't even like say that they're restarting the match or anything.
I know, yeah.
It was kind of a screw job for Morocco.
Yeah, Morocco did kind of get screwed on that one. But
I mean, it's too bad. You know, a lot of these matches, and it was a trend at this time in the WWF, honestly, is just bad finishes. You know, I don't know if Patterson wasn't involved yet really in a lot of the booking of these matches, but the finishes were just awful for a while here.
Yeah, they were.
And it was an epidemic we saw in the NWA, and we used to review those shows in the early 80s as well. Like, they'd have these great matches, and the ends would just be so anticlimactic. And that continues here with this show. Just a lot of kind of weird endings and finishes.
Yeah, I mean, you had, you know, DQs and weird countouts and, like, unusual roll-ups and, like, you know, finishing moves out of nowhere and just really weird. Like, they didn't know where to go with it, so let's just finish it. These were not Pat's ideas. I can't imagine him coming up with stuff this inept. Definitely not his cup of tea. But in any event, Tito Santana does get the win, your Intercontinental Champion. And I kind of like, you know, Jesse's just so great. And it's really depressing. This is probably the reason why, if I was ever asked, you know, what is your favorite era ever in professional, in as a wrestling fan, at least WWF, it would definitely be the Federation years. Simply for the reason, just the attention to detail that's just not here now. And Jesse would harp in this match, not smart for the Intercontinental Champion to be in a tournament. He doesn't need to be in a tournament.
Especially with a banged-up leg.
Banged up leg, and you know, all these guys that want to be IC champions, you know, they can injure him and set him up for future title shots. This guy's just so brilliant,
right?
You know, just knew how to put this stuff over, and nobody can do that now. Nobody.
Well, they don't care enough to.
No, they don't care enough to. It's all about others. Well, we're not going to get that now. But anyway, Morocco gets hose jobbed here.
Yeah.
The only thing they weren't intending to detail was the endings,
right?
Really.
Yeah.
But Tito moves on. He takes on the winner of this match, another gem.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, probably the our last match of the first round. And the only match that really has, not the only match, but the one match that has kind of a legitimate backstory to it. And that is freshly minted face, Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff, taking on his former cohort, Ace Cowboy Bob Orton, of course. Orndorff teaming with Orton's guy, the Hot Rod, a few months earlier, March of 85 at WrestleMania 1. And then they left, even though it was Orton's fault, him and Piper pretty much left Orndorff in the ring after Orndorff got whacked with a cast. So he was out to get revenge. And Orndorff would take on Ace here in the final match of the first round. I don't think we did a fact for Orndorff at WrestleMania 1. Why don't you give us a little background on Mr. Wonderful right now?
All right. After a brief run in professional football, Paul Orndorff focused his sights on pro wrestling in 1976. Hooked up with the Mid-South territory in Memphis. After leaving Memphis, Orndorff continued to win gold across various NWA territories, settling eventually in Alabama in 1979. 1980, he went back to Mid-South, worked various opponents until 1982, moved on to Georgia, then went to Japan before finally signing with the WWF in late 1983. And just to take a quick sidestep from this, you can see, too, the path that so many of these guys took through all these territories, really owning their skills and their characters. You know, it's like, yep. Oh, he went to Memphis, then he went to Mid-South, then he went to Alabama, then he went to Georgia, then he went to, you know, Japan, then he went to Stampede. You know, like some of these guys just really, really made the rounds before heading here.
Absolutely.
That really helped them. So he signed in late 1983. By early 84, he's now aligned with Roddy Piper, became one of the hottest heels in the territory, dubbed Mr. Wonderful, Paul Orndorff. Piper was actually his manager for a little bit, and then he started wrestling, and Bobby Heenan started managing Orndorff. They terrorized WWF faces, eventually leading him to a mega feud with Hulk Hogan as 1984 is coming to a close. Orndorff, of course, as you mentioned, teamed with Piper to battle Hogan and Mr. T at the first WrestleMania. After some miscommunication, Orndorff ate the pin. He would become the scapegoat for the loss. Piper turned on him, and Orndorff became quite the hot face, dumping Heenan and aligning himself with Hulk Hogan. A bitter Heenan then placed a $25,000 bounty on anyone that could put Orndorff on the shelf, and that bounty would eventually be increased to $50,000 as the weeks went on, and that comes into play here as well, because they mentioned it throughout, you know, that Ace is looking for the bounty as well as winning the tournament match.
Right. Yep. A little background on the Cowboys, since he technically was not at in the match at the first WrestleMania. Obviously, he is the son of Bob Orton Sr. Jr. began his career in Florida and Georgia in 1972. Brief stop in New York. He was in WWF very early on. Orton would head to Mid-Atlantic as the decade turned. He'd be involved in a memorable angle, and this was one of the even my pre-WWF watching, this was one of the first awesome feuds that I remember very young as a kid, and that was when he and Dick Slater paid off by Harley Race to take out Ric Flair in 1983. And what happened was it was a house show match, or I guess what it was called, like a TV taping. And Slater and Orton would beat the shit out of Flair and give him a spike pile driver and break his neck. It was just an awesome feud. After that run, Orton returned to the WWF in 1984, and he became Ace. He became the Ace and became Roddy Piper's bodyguard, always stood behind him during the Piper's pits. In early 85, Jimmy Snuka broke Bob Orton's forearm, and from that point forward, Orton wore a cast in his arm. Even 2 years later, when the cast was no longer broken, and that was always the infamous running joke. There's actually a great TNT segment where Piper and Orton would go to the doctor, and then Piper would write on the x-rays and make up cracks and make up breaks and rip the doctors. Awesome segments on TNT involving this phony broken arm, but of course is the infamous cast that the Cowboy would have on his arm for pretty much his whole career.
Right. In another match of two great veterans that really knew how to work, a lot of mat stuff, and you know, Orndorff worked the arm, and then Orton would come back and use his cast a little bit, you know, to turn control. And I just really liked Monsoon and Venturi here again, putting the bounty angle over, wondering if not only Orton would cash in, but anyone else later in the night. And it really looked like Orton was going to win this, and I actually thought he should have, to be honest with you. It felt like it was going that way, and I think he could have used the win a little bit more than Orndorff. And it's like Orndorff goes over strong here, because Orton ends up using the cast, and the referee saw it and DQ'd him. So I liked the heel work by Orton, helped further his character. I thought maybe he should have gotten the win here to help really push him along further, because I liked just his heel tactics throughout the match.
Yeah, he was definitely in that groove. You know, Orndorff, he was freshly minted. It was a tough spot here because obviously you don't want to kill, you don't want to kill Orndorff's, you know, babyface momentum. But at the same time, Orton was actually wrestling a really good match. Mm-hmm. So it was a tough one. But Orton didn't have the job. He gets caught. It's pretty dumb, too, because, you know, the referee's staring right at him and he just takes the catch and cracks him with it. It was like so stupid.
Yeah.
So the Mr. Wonderful, freshly minted face, moves on. So here is our quarterfinal matchups. Adrian Adonis will take on the Dynamite Kid. Randy Savage will face Ricky Steamboat. Junkyard Dog against Moondog Spot. And Tito Santana against Paul Orndorff.
And a great lineup other than the Adonis, the Junkyard Dog match. Other than that, it's a good lineup.
Great lineup. So we actually are going to take a break because, wow, that first round went much longer than I thought it did. But we had a lot of guys. We had a lot of guys we wanted to get you to introduce you to.
Should move a little bit quicker from here.
Yeah, we should get quicker from here. But first, we'll take a break and take a listen to our good friends from WrestleChat.net. Because
promotional considerations been paid for by the following.
How many pro wrestling news websites do you visit to get your daily news? 3, 4, maybe 5? Do yourself a favor and make that number 1. WrestleChat.net, the only professional wrestling news site that brings you all wrestling news all day long, and is home of the critically acclaimed Still Real to Us podcast, starring former CZW, ROH, and ECW announcer Eric Gargiulo and the champ Jeff Peck. That's WrestleChat.net. WrestleChat, it's where it's at.
And of course, half the guys that we're talking about would end up being on Nitro in about 10 years. It's becoming enhancement talents. WrestleChat.net, your home for everything pro wrestling. WWE, TNA, Ring of Honor. They have a great message board, and of course, the awesome podcast. Speaking of podcasts, if you're perusing the website, you see the PTB Nova, proudly worn by George Duncan. Click on it. It'll go right to our Podbean page. And there you are. You can listen to any of our 100 and currently 15, eventually 16 once we post this one. WrestleChat.net, your home for everything pro wrestling. Also, of course, they sponsor our news and notes segment during our weekly headline show. WrestleChat.net, your home for everything pro wrestling. Also want to shout out to our good friend Graham Cawthon and his historyofwwe.com, a fantastic research site. You and I, JR, have used it extensively for all of our materials. Great results and write-ups, DVD write-ups, pay-per-views, columns, all sorts of great stuff. Thehistoryofwwe.com, your source for everything historical in pro wrestling. And, of course, he's been doing the site for 10 years now. He's added TNA. He's added Ring of Honor. Graham is a great guy. We've had him on a couple times, one of our favorite people, and we'll have him back on again for a future vault. Not sure which one. We got one kind of picked out. Sometime in the next, in the first half of 1996, we'll have him on for
And Graham will also be joining us on April 12th because the Place to Be podcast will be very happy to bring on Gary Michael Capetta for an interview. Michael Capetta, the great ring announcer from the NWA, WCW, WWF, AWA, and Ring of Honor over the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Graham will be joining us to conduct that interview with him. So we look forward to that. Of course, you can listen to that interview via our Podbean page on Facebook or our new home on the Stitcher Radio app. You can visit that at Stitcher.com. The most recent episode is available there to stream for you. And on your mobile app or your iPad app, you actually can now access the last 10 episodes. They're all available on there for you. So if you don't want to download them, you don't want to take up space on your computer or your phone, you know, critical space on your phone or your iPad or anything like that, you can just go ahead and stream them right from that website. So visit us on our Facebook page, at our Podbean page, or on Stitcher.com.
Excellent. Okay. All right. Well done. You know, we just had our 100th episode, and you know, obviously we're 15 into season 2, if you will, and our plugs just get more and more, and it's just it's a testament to you, PTB Nation, for continuing to listen. And
I think Stitcher, that was a good grab for us because there's a lot of podcasts on there, and we come up easily on the search. And I already looked; we got a few decent hits for our last episode already, and you know, it was only up for a day, so people are obviously using it, which is great to see. And it's really good. I tried it out. I got the new iPad, and I tested it out on there, and it works really well, and it just streams right on there, so you don't have to download the file or anything. You can just play it right off there as a stream. So, pretty
neat. I'll have to try it on my goddaughter's iPad. Maybe she can listen.
Yeah, you got to download the app. I mean, you can go to the website, but it's only the most recent episode available on the website. So, if you want the previous 10, you have to download the app either to your iPad or phone, you know, Android or whatever. So,
right, exactly. Okay, so. Place to be, folks, is everywhere. Everywhere is the place to be. Everywhere. So Facebook, Stitcher, Podbean, you name it, we're there. Place to Be podcast. And we are talking tonight about the Wrestling Classic. Let us move on now to the quarterfinals. First match pits the Dynamite Kid, who defeated Nikolai Volkov, taking on Adrian Adonis, who defeated Corporal Kirshner.
Yeah, another good match.
Yeah, I like this match.
You know, two more guys that can really bump and work well together. You had a nice little mix of Dynamite's kind of speed and Adonis trick, you know, sneaky speed for a big guy, but he really worked at his ground and slowed Dynamite down a little bit and worked his leg over. I thought he hooked on a nice little Scorpion Deathlock during here. You said it was pretty bad, but I actually disagreed with you. I thought it was pretty tight looking. And, you know, it was a move we didn't really see him a lot in the WWF at this time. So, and then at the end, Adonis collides with Jimmy Hart. Dynamite just rolls him up and pins him. A little weird spot that Adonis actually got his foot on the rope, but everyone just misses it and no one says anything. They just move along. So,
no, I thought that was funny.
But yeah, two of the best bumpers in the promotion get 5 minutes and tell a nice little story, and Dynamite advances. So a good push for Dynamite here.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe they had some solo run thoughts for him even while teaming with Davey Boy. So Dynamite moves on to the semifinals, and he'll take on the winner of this match. 322 is just such a
what a tease.
Yeah, it's just so wrong. The Macho Man Randy Savage, and not yet the Dragon, but soon would be the Dragon, Ricky Steamboat. And
you know, it's almost like this show. And maybe it was intended to be this way. It's like just kind of teasing these little appetizers of matches. Well, we'll give you a few minutes of Steamboat and Savage. Yeah, I'll give you a couple minutes of Orndorff and Tito. Yeah, here's a little bit of you know, Dynamite and Adonis, a little Davey Boy and Steamboat. You know, it's almost like they wanted to really entice you to come out. Maybe that was the point of the show, you know, more than anything. Maybe that's why the matches are so short.
Yeah, and it's entirely possible. I don't disagree with that. Maybe you're because by the summer of '86, Steamboat and Savage are on the house show circuit almost weekly,
right,
almost nightly. And there's a match. I don't know if it's on Steamboat's DVD. It's on somebody's DVD. It's either Steamboat. They have a match at Boston Garden that's just an
absolute. Yeah, I think it's on Steamboat's.
Yeah, it's just an unbelievable bloodbath. Just an awesome, awesome match.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of matches that people have said they thought are better than three. WrestleMania 3, the Garden match and the one at Maple Leaf Gardens is also supposed to be tremendous. That they had around this time. So there are matches that are supposed to be even better than the WrestleMania 3 match when they were rehearsing the 3 match around the circuit.
Yeah. Yep. And it just
this is not one of them.
No, and it's a shame. This is almost like an appetizer. Like you said, this is an appetizer to a future main course. And Steamboat was a guy for a guy so young, he was pretty much bulletproof at this point anyway. So him losing is not the end of the world.
No, not
and
at
Savage
all.
Cheated anyway. He used the same you know, taped up knuckles in his tights that he would end up using, 3 months later to become the Intercontinental Champion. So Steamboat gets jobbed here, and the Macho Man cheats to move on, and he will go into the semifinals and take on the Dynamite Kid. This is ridiculous. I mean, seriously, this should have been like a day-long tournament and give each of these matches 20 minutes.
I know. Ridiculous. And again, Jesse pushes his agenda here too some more, which is great.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. It's almost like he's Savage's manager. It was awesome. Absolutely awesome. So we go from those two matches, which were highly entertaining, to this here. The match that is...
I got my 2x4. I got the American flag. American flag. I got my 2x4.
1985... Hacksaw Jim Duggan was kicking some serious ass in Mid-South /
yes,
Universal.
Yeah, he was. I got
debuted in 82 in Mid-South and had quite the run there, of course. You know, teamed up with DiBiase and the Brat Pack, whatever the fuck they were, the Brat Pack. DiBiase, Matt Bourne, and Mr. Olympia. And feuded with Hacksaw Butch Reed. You know, had a good feud with JYD. Tore up New Orleans in the Mid-South wrestling territory, so... probably his peak of his career, I'd say, as far as in-ring ability goes.
And you know why this was awesome? What you just did, number one, we didn't have to listen to LaRue's voice.
Yes.
And
well, number two, it's not a WCW update, you know?
Well, that is true. And number two, I don't even care what the reason was. And number two, you interrupted what was about to be a description of a truly, truly disastrous match. So good timing this week on that for the second straight week. I don't remember why last week. I think it was during... I don't know. He cut in during another great moment that we wanted to skip, but
And one little interesting fact, actually, he actually won the tag team titles in the UWF along with Magnum TA.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, you know what? Everyone wants to say that I give the Don't Guy any credit for being a great wrestler. So as soon as Watts. As soon as Jim Watts can get the footage from his wife, then I'll watch it, and then you can tell me that I'm wrong and that he's an awesome wrestler.
No, he was in Mid-South. Yes, he was great.
Yeah. Till then, he's nothing more than a snot blowing buffoon. So come on, Jim Watts, let's get on the ball here.
Yes.
Pretty soon people are going to wonder if the guy's name is James. It's pretty funny. All right. In the match that's traditionally known by Mean Gene as the Black Dog versus the White Jack Dog.
You dirty Black Dog.
Dirty Black Dog. The Junkyard Dog takes on Moondog Spot. Whatever. I mean, it's another disaster.
Well, the ref doesn't even come down in this match.
Yeah, JYD just does it himself.
JYD assaults him, pins him, and counts himself, and that's it. They just move along.
They move along. It's such a disaster.
I don't get it. I don't know if the ref just missed a spot or they just didn't give a fuck, but whatever. I mean,
Spot goes
down in 25 seconds, and JYD continues quite the unimpressive run through the tournament.
I know, really. He'll take on the winner of this match. Boy, another great matchup. Mm-hmm.
And this one gets some time now. We get 8 minutes here, so.
Yes. Tito Santana, your Intercontinental Champion, takes on a guy that conceivably, might have been number one contender.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? Maybe they wrestled on the house show circuit. Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff.
Two faces going at it, too, which is cool.
Yes. But as usual, who's great? Jesse.
Yes.
Says, oh, yeah, Orndorff thinks he's happy now, but we'll see the real Mr. Wonderful in this match. Yeah. And sure enough, I think he did punch like Tito in the face.
Well, there's two great storylines in this match. One, you have Tito's thigh is taped up, and and Jesse does wonder, is Orndorff going to target the thigh? Is he going to try and inflict some damage? And then the other is still the bounty storyline going on, saying, does Tito have it in him to try and cash in on Orndorff? And I think he does, and Gorilla's like, oh, he won't do that or whatever. So
right.
It was a good little, another fun little storyline mixed in. And again, another match that could have used some more time, but at least they got 8 minutes. And Orndorff really just kept drilling over Tito's leg, working it over. And, eventually they tumbled out to the floor and would both get countered out, which I think is a fitting ending here. I mean, I'm okay with one bye in a tournament, so. Fitting ending that these two guys, it can really choose which of them could go over, and this gets JYD a bye into the finals.
Yes. Yeah, and, Tito, obviously, one of the more unheralded in-ring guys, and, Orndorff is pretty hot here. So, what's funny is everyone talks about the early years of the Federation era being just a bunch of cartoony guys, and everybody, the NWA fans ripped Vince for having a roster full of, inept morons. And let's be honest, nothing could be further from the truth.
Right.
A lot of guys in this roster really were good workers, and it's all Vince. It's Vince's fault because he doesn't let these guys really show their stuff. He cared more about how they looked.
Yeah. I think there are, maybe not. Maybe I'm just guessing at this, but I think these guys probably got more time a lot of times on house shows. I mean, we've seen that kind of borne out, in 24/7 watching some of these shows
right there.
And, that was the business back then. Even the pay-per-views weren't really meant to be the big cash cows. TV and pay-per-views were still meant to draw you to the arena. And we saw that with WrestleMania 1, where he didn't even blow off some feuds. He had feuds not even matched up or not even continued because he wanted you to still come to the houses. And, Tito was involved in one of those with Greg Valentine. They kept apart at WrestleMania because they wanted to keep that feud going on the house show circuit. So the houses are where you paid to see the big matches. So, you still got crappy finishes with the guys because they didn't want guys to lose until they were really done with them. But, I think these guys were given more time and more leeway. As you see with that Steamboat and Savage, that's a perfect example. They were really given time to go out there and work in those house shows. So, I don't think we saw a lot of it because on TV they were just a lot of squash matches and stuff like that. But and not all of the house shows were great work rate. I mean, you usually have the first three or four matches were just god-awful time limit draws between two, low-end jobbers. So,
right.
But I think there are a lot of hidden gems on those house shows.
Oh, there's no question. And I think that's the benefit of 24/7. I really hope when they do eventually launch the network, they put a lot of these. It'd be good overnight stuff. It'd be good stuff to put on in the middle of the night to kill time,
Tito's one of those guys I've really gained more of an appreciation from 24/7, just watching some of his stuff. And God, he had just two house show matches that are just tremendous if you can track them down. I actually reviewed them both. If you go to the message board under my section of reviews, there was one from 1984 where him and Valentine fought. It was just a fucking war. And then another one from 88, late 88, where they matched up again. Completely different looks and attitudes at that point. But they another match was just a slugfest. They just pounded the crap out of each other. And just two great different matches, and just showed you what a great worker Tito really was.
He was a tremendous worker, and so was so was the Hammer, for that matter. And it's a shame that the house show, this was a this show is kind of getting me a little sentimental because it reminds me of the days when the house shows were such a big deal, and now the house shows are just a complete pile of crap. Although, on a side note, and I meant to mention this on our headline show, and I forgot. It was kind of cool they showed that whole Triple H thing with the house show.
No, you did mention that. You did.
I did mention that. Okay. Yeah, I thought that was great. And again, now this is another great example of just – it was so nice to just pay, you know, $8, you know, or $10 or – I mean, I don't know what you paid back in the day at the Dunk. I don't know how much house show tickets were by now. I guess I went to shows too, but you know, I could get a good seat at the New Haven Coliseum for, you know, $11, and I could sit there for, and tapings were a little more expensive, maybe like $18, but you could sit there for 5 hours and watch, like, you know, 30 matches. Of course, 22 of them were, you know, like the Boondog Spot Junkyard Dog match. But, you know, it was good to see Scott Casey or, you know, Sal G wrestle like 11 times a night, but it's just, the house shows are just so great, and it was just so much fun, and you know, it's so different. I'm kind of glad that we kind of took a detour tonight and did this, because it kind of reminds me back of how different things were back then, and how much different the product and the landscape was. But in any event, enough reminiscing. So there's your semifinals. The Junkyard Dog moves on to the next round, since he doesn't have to wrestle either of these guys.
Yeah, so he's in the finals now.
So he's in the finals, and he'll take on the winner of another great in-ring matchup, the Macho Man Randy Savage and the Dynamite Kid. But we are now about to give you the match that pretty much brought the people here. It wasn't the tournament, that's for sure. Your World Wrestling Federation Heavyweight Championship. The word heavyweight was used often back then. I don't think they took the heavyweight off for a while. Your champion, the iconic, the incredible Hulk Hogan, taking on the Hot Rod, not the Hot Scott, Rowdy Roddy Piper. Again, we were so hyped up on the history of WrestleMania, we didn't give these guys bios. I'm going to defer to you, sir. Would you like to do the Hot Rod or the Orange Goblin?
I'll do the Orange Goblin for you.
Okay. All right.
Terry Bollea. Okay.
Well, I was going to do the Challenger first. But that's...
All right, go ahead.
Okay. Roderick Toombs was from Canada, Western Canada. Left home as a young teenager, traveled the country, living in, like, YMCAs and church basements and... made his pro wrestling debut at the age of 15, and if you watch his DVD, a priest told him to be a wrestler. Otherwise, he said he'd end up in prison. In 1973, he went south to the United States, began a stretch with a newly named Roddy Piper, competed as an enhancement talent in Kansas City, Texas, and with Vern Gagne in the AWA. Eventually, he landed in California. It was there that he received his first sustained push. By late 1975, he was a top heel in Roy Shire's NWA San Francisco promotion and with the LaBelles in Los Angeles. In 1980, he moved across the country and joined NWA's iconic Mid-Atlantic territory. He and best friend Ric Flair would have a red-hot feud. Also spent time in Georgia as a heel color commentator because they saw that he had a knack for it, had a talent for it. Piper would eventually turn face, became embroiled in tremendous feuds with now heel Flair, Sergeant Slaughter, and probably the feud that he is most remembered for in Mid-Atlantic, and that was with then United States heavyweight champion Greg the Hammer Valentine. The two actually feuded over the belt. And obviously, the match that they'll always be remembered for is one of my favorite matches of all time, and that was the bloody, violent dog collar match from the very first Starrcade in 1983, where he had the ear injury and Valentine was pummeling his side of his head with a chain and blood's oozing out of his ear. And, it was a tremendous match. And it was the end of a great feud. In late 83, he turned heel again, fulfilled his final NWA dates because he kind of wanted to get his heel persona back, because in 1984, he would be heading up the coast and would be a member of the World Wrestling Federation. I believe he was nursing an injury, so I think that's why he did not immediately start in the ring. He would be
It was the ear injury from Starrcade.
Yeah, the ear injury, which was real, by the way. It wasn't fake. So he had to get his equilibrium back. So he ended up managing, as my PIC mentioned earlier, managed Paul Orndorff. He also managed another iconic mid-80s heel, Dr. D. David Schultz, who I had the pleasure of being in the same movie theater with once, which was very kind of intimidating and cool at the same time. By the way, it had to do with Piper because my friends and I went to see They Live. And sure enough, for those that don't know, Dr. D. David Schultz would end up becoming a bounty hunter. When he was kind of healing his injuries, Vince had the idea of, we need you on the mic more. And Piper pretty much said, well, I got an idea. Thus began the talk show segment of which every talk show segment afterwards would be measured. And that is, of course, the great Piper's Pit. And, of course, much of 84 was centered around his feud with Jimmy Snuka, the infamous coconut smack. Mm-hmm. Then, obviously, by 1985, he was obviously the top heel in the company. And who would you have the top heel with? The top face. And, of course, he and Hulk Hogan had a title match at the War to settle the score. And that was just insane. I mean, Piper had the Hulkamania shirt on, and he was cheating, and all the cops came in the ring. And mm-hmm. it was an absolute debacle. But it was so much fun, and that, of course, led to the match at WrestleMania, which takes us to where we are now. His opponent is, sir?
Hulk Hogan. Terry Bollea, lifelong wrestling fan, discovered in a gym by the Briscoes, eventually trained by Hiro Matsuda. Made his pro debut in Florida, but quickly burned out thanks to Matsuda's strict training regimen. After some time away, Bollea craved to return to the business he loved, along with friend Ed Leslie, got back to the game in Alabama. After a run as the Boulder brothers, Bollea and Leslie were offered more money to jump to Memphis by Jerry Jarrett, and they quickly accepted. After a local TV appearance where he dwarfed Lou Ferrigno, Jarrett dubbed him Terry the Hulk Boulder. Late 1979, Bollea was lured to New York by Vince McMahon Sr. and was given the in-ring name of Hulk Hogan. After a successful run and spending some time owning his skills in Japan, Bollea was offered a role in Rocky III. McMahon refused to let him participate in the movie, so Hogan quit the WWF, realizing that his role in Rocky III would be much better from him than anything else he had going on at the time. So he joined the AWA instead, because they allowed him to do such things. An early heel run turned into a red-hot face turn in the birth of Hulkamania. As 1983 ticked away, Hogan saw the writing on the wall and where the AWA was headed and decided to return to New York. On December 27th, Hogan returned to WWF TV, solidified his New York face persona by saving Bob Backlund from an attack a few weeks later. On January 23rd, Hogan shocked WWF fans by knocking off the Iron Sheik to win the WWF Championship. His star exploded from there as the year went on, and along with Vince McMahon, who is now the man who would help lead the promotion from becoming just a strong regional territory into a multi-million dollar national wrestling company. And he was over like Rover, as the kids say, just big time. Mm-hmm. With the fans. And Roddy Piper was just a fucking heat magnet at this time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was a son of a bitch.
The heat was just insane for him. And honestly, the feud with him and Jimmy Snuka and Tonga Kid was just awesome, awesome stuff. And I implore you, I know I've said this before on this show, find that Roddy Piper Coliseum home video and watch it. The one from like 1986, I think it came out or whatever. You know, it has the infamous Piper's Pit where he interviews himself. And, has the Halloween Saturday Night's Main Event skit with him and Vince McMahon doing the trick-or-treating. But the real treat of that tape is they show a lot of the feud with Snuka and Tonga Kid. And just the heat for those matches is just off the charts. And the brawls that they would have is just tremendous. And I know I've been accused of underrating this match here. And maybe I just wasn't in the mood the day I watched it. Maybe it deserved better because, one of the guys on our board said, you know, these were events, these matches. They weren't meant to be to matches. You know, they were meant to be events. And you know, that's what this is here, really. Piper comes marching to the ring. You know, heat is raining down on him, and he just looks so confident and angry as he walks to the ring. And just a wild start. They spill right to the floor. They brawl around the ring and brawl back and forth. And eventually Piper just grabs a chair, and Hogan wrestles it off. And Orton gets in the ring, and there's a DQ after 7 minutes. But just a wild, wild brawl, and the crowd just loves every single minute of it.
You're dealing with two guys who figured it out. They got it. And for both sides of the equation. Yes, Hogan wanted to be Thunder Lips. And Vince Sr., that's not in the equation. And then he went to the AWA. And then, of course, you know, Vern liked Hogan only to a certain extent, but would never let him actually beat Nick Bockwinkle for the AWA title. And that's right. Where I think where he saw the writing was on the wall. As for Piper, you know, it takes a lot. It's easy to be – we've always talked about this, and this is a basic 101 of professional wrestling. It's very easy to be a babyface. It is very hard to be put over as an absolute son of a bitch.
Some wrestlers say it's the other way around, though, that it's easy to be the heel because you can just, you know, be an asshole. It's harder to be a face and be interesting.
Well, you know what? I think it's hard either way because it's one. You know, you could be a heel and not have nobody give a shit, and you could be a face and have nobody give a shit. So, I concur in that. But it just seemed like Piper, you know, it takes a lot to be. I mean, Hogan beat the Sheik and immediately he was the best guy in the whole world.
Right. Yeah.
Whereas Piper just, you know, he needed to work really hard to be a complete fucking prick, and he.
Hey, I may have a winner.
Art, you're not a prick. We love you. And at this point, I mean, that match at. I mean, this match has a lot of heat. Chicago fans are awesome wrestling fans. We know that. But that, just like that War to Settle the Score match at the Garden, I mean, that place was just off the, the roof just blew off and the cops are running around. It was freaking, it was chaos.
Yeah.
All started by the Hot Rod. The guy was no dummy. He figured it out. Hogan went right along, you know, with it, and he got his, he held his end of the bargain.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, work rate wise, these two never really cared.
No.
You know what I mean? I mean, it's nothing fancy.
And him and Orton beat Hogan down after the match, and Orndorff makes a save to keep that thing going, but. You know, I'm pretty sure this is about it for Hogan and Piper. They don't really feud too much more after this. So this is, in effect, their blow-off because Hogan will move on to other issues heading into WrestleMania. And then, of course, the issue with Orndorff as 86 went along and Piper had his own issues going on with Mr. T and eventually Adrian Adonis. So this is pretty much it for their feud that's dominated 1985.
Exactly. And it didn't have a blow-off. I guess that's just how Piper worked. That's how he rolled.
Yeah, Piper, I mean, they weren't going to job him. So.
Nah, not at all. And obviously it was going to win the title. Because I don't think he would have been as good with the title. You know, Piper, another thing you got to give him credit for, Piper was one of those guys who, as great a heel as he was, being the champion meant nothing to him.
Right.
He just wanted to humiliate Hogan and make him bark like a dog. He didn't care about the belt. The belt meant nothing to him. It would have been nothing more than a trinket. And I used to love, because Pipe, you know, all those guys, except for Hogan's t-shirt, nobody really had t-shirts back then. It was pretty much the two of them. Hogan had his Hulkamania shirt, and he had his Hot Rod shirt. But Hogan would have that American-made one, and then Piper would have, he either wore a blue Superman t-shirt, or he'd wear that awesome Black Panther shirt. Not Black Panther, the group. Right. He'd have a white shirt.
You dirty black dog.
Dirty black dog. It was a white shirt that had a Black Panther on the front. I asked my brother the other day, and he didn't remember that t-shirt. I said, he wore it constantly. I think he wore it more than he wore the Hot Rod shirt.
And Piper, so, yeah, he pretty much just feuded with Orndorff and actually a little bit with Bruno Sammartino throughout the rest of 85.
Yes. And then that would siphon into he'd be with Savage, I think, at some point as well, feuding with Bruno. Well, maybe that'd be a little bit later on down the line. So Hogan retains his title. Piper still is a son of a bitch. And the crowd was revved up.
Mm-hmm.
Would you put this match last?
You know, I was just thinking of that as you were talking. And, yeah, I probably would have, actually. I think it was big enough that it should have went on last. I know they didn't really have a decisive finish, but I don't think that mattered.
No.
Yeah, I think it probably should have ended the show.
Yeah. So let's go back to the tournament. We have only one semifinal match as the Junkyard
Dog.
Actually,
this is what I don't get either. I don't get why they didn't have it after this match instead of making the winner of this match wrestle back-to-back matches. I know they do the Rolls Royce in between, but... I would have at least put it here, if not last.
Right. The Macho Man, Randy Savage, takes on the Dynamite Kid in yet another appetizer to what could possibly be a 15, 20, 30.
God, well, I mean, what a great little slew of matches we've been treated to here. Not long ones, but just cool matchups. Like, God, we get to see Savage and Steamboat and Savage and Dynamite and Steamboat and Davey Boy. Like, just those three matches alone are tremendous.
Right, and then throw in Tito Morocco and Orndorff. Orton, just awesome
Tito
matchups.
Tito Orndorff.
Tito Orndorff, just awesome matchups. And these two go just under 5 minutes, and Savage wins with a cradle. He hasn't won one match with his finisher.
No, not at all in the whole show. And, you know, it's clear at this point the tournament's being used to showcase Savage as a legitimate player. And it made sense because it was shortly after the show he entered into a little house show feud with Hogan anyway. So, it makes sense that they're really using him. So, and you could tell he's starting to wear down a little bit. He was a little bit slower than Dynamite. Nasty top rope superplex was great, though.
Yes.
And Savage recovered just long enough. Dynamite lifted his legs and Savage cradled him for the win. So, could have been another classic. Instead, we only get 4.5 minutes, but, or actually 4:50, so just under 5 minutes. But Savage advances to the finals to face the Junkyard Dog.
Yes.
In between, they give away the Rolls Royce presented to contest winner Michael Hamley. There you go.
That was not me. And the JYD then takes on the Macho Man in the main event. Savage, first
the longest match of the night, 10 minutes,
yeah,
just about.
Almost 10 minutes, yeah, 9:42. And what's funny, the first of two times in his career that Savage would have to wrestle four times in one night.
I know.
He's like the precursor to Bret Hart. And, you know, the match isn't bad. A lot of stalling.
Yeah.
It was a lot of – you could tell that Savage was slightly gassed.
Yeah, he was hurt. I mean, he was clearly worn down and taking his time. And they played that up on commentary. But I really like the story here. Once Savage took over, he knocks Dog to the floor and just beats the shit out of him. You never see this really as a tactic by someone. He just kept attacking him on the floor. He hit two stiff top rope accidental drops, even used a chair. And every time Dog would get in, Savage would knock him back out and just beat on him on the floor. And, you know, it's just a really cool strategy that you don't see a lot of, like utilizing outside the ring is more than just a place to brawl wildly. You know, he was using it as part of his strategy. Right. They finally would head back in, and Dog would send Savage flying over the top, and that was pretty much the bump of the night in my eyes. Savage just goes flying over the top rope and down to the floor, and that would be too much. He just couldn't continue, so he gets countered out, and JYD wins. The tournament finished a little weird. I mean, it kept Savage looking strong, made him look gutty, just took one too many shots to continue. After the match was great, Jesse gets in JYD's face, defends his boy.
Yes, threatening revenge.
Yeah, threatens revenge. So it was a good brawl. But even though he didn't win, Savage just clearly comes out the star, and he should have just won. I don't know. Even if they had him cheat with Jesse's help or something, he earned the win here. JYD, he wrestles Iron Sheik in a okay match, and that stupid nonsense with Spot, and then the bye. So, Savage really earned this. He probably should have won this tournament.
Yeah, I agree. And look, we love you, Jet. We love you, Dog. God rest your soul. But seriously, it's just such a, disappointment. Mm. Overall, not good matches. I mean, his matches were an abomination.
Yeah.
Where Savage actually had some legitimate, real, wars that he was brawling with, but. So, Junkyard Dog wins the big tournament, pretty much the highlight of his WWF career, pretty much. And there you go. So, but Savage looks like a star.
Yes, easy. Easy star of the show.
Easy star. And he easily, is the future of the company.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. There is the Wrestling Classic, complete with the Lech, Lord Alfred, who took a note from Mean Gene's book of... Of hitting on women twice his age.
Yes.
Or half his age.
Yes, half his age.
Half his age.
So the show itself, it is what it is. It's full of short, matches. Some are meant for comedy. Some are meant to get guys over. And a lot of non-finishes. The crowd was really hot, I thought, throughout the show. And if there is one thing this show reveals to us is the incredibly talented depth that they had in the promotion at this time. There's so many great, great hands that could really just work a good match. And you just look up and down the show, and really there's not that many bad workers on it at all. So they had a great roster at this time. This show was really a snapshot, a showcase of that time period. If you're unfamiliar with 1985 WWF and you want to kind of see what it was like, I recommend the show from a character perspective. And, if you're able to glean talent out of short matches, then this is for you. But if you like, in-depth matches and storylines, then I would probably stay away from this one. But,
yeah.
If you're into 85 wrestling and specifically WWF, this is a cool show to throw in and kind of relive. I enjoyed going back and watching it really for the first time in a while. And really for the first time with a keen eye. I watched it, like I said, back when I was younger, I wasn't really into it like I was this time around. So,
right. And, I watched it... last time I watched it was when you and I first started talking and first started thinking about reviews, and I had skipped ahead. We didn't start writing until I think it was WrestleMania 5. So really the last time I had watched it before a few weeks ago was, like 9 years ago. So it was nice to, and it was probably maybe the third or fourth time I'd ever seen the show. It was nice to kind of look at it with, like you said, with a different eye and really appreciating some of the things about it and realizing some of it was still a pile of shit. So, but now enough of talking about us.
Yes.
And our thoughts. Let's dive into PTB Nation and your comments, courtesy of our awesome Facebook page.
Yeah, and I'll kick us off. And I want to apologize. You're going to have to deal with my baby mush brain that I have going on right now because I just completely brain farted. And I remembered on the way to work this morning to put the thread up. So we still got 12 comments, which is good. So I apologize to anyone who didn't get their comment in. I will try and get our next one up. And you know what? Don't be afraid to message me. I know you guys are all pretty open with contacting me. So if you don't see the thread up for the vault by like Thursday morning or so, just hit me up and I'll post it. Because odds are I probably just forgot. So, all right. Let's start with Jason Greenhouse. I thought doing cocaine causes a person to lose weight. Well, not in Adrian Adonis' case. My God, was he one big, fat, sloppy pig. David Boy, Ricky Steamboat, as well as Mr. Wonderful and Tito had the rarity in the mid-80s with a face-versus-face matchup. Terry Funk spitting his chew in the camera, lovely. Gotta love the pre-wellness testing era. Morocco, both Bulldogs, Sheiky Baby, Mr. Wonderful, and Ivan Putski were all jacked out of their minds. Alfred Hayes trying to jump the bones of the eye candy that was hanging with VKM backstage. Savage Dynamite had the match of the night. Savage ends up working four times. The guy was simply amazing. Congratulations to the schnook who won the Rolls Royce. What a crock of shit that was. And speaking of the big, fat, sloppy pig, he wasn't on the show at all, huh?
I guess not. He wasn't. Was he managing anybody? No, he really
wasn't. Yeah, well, he was with the U.S. Express, right?
He wasn't. Yeah, they weren't. Yeah, and he doesn't glom onto the Bulldogs for at least another month. So.
Well, not until they're in the tag title picture.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, once he gets the number one contender, then he jumps on their bandwagon. Exactly. All right, Corey Ferreira. I never saw the fuss people made about this show. Apart from a Hogan-Piper match and Savage winning the tournament, we wish, it just seems like a large house show in my eyes. The show also gives us a minus five-star match at JYD Moondog Spot, only to be followed by a four-star Savage Dynamite Kid match. It is good seeing Dynamite wrestle singles in WWF, especially seeing him go with Savage. Also of note is Savage Steamboat for the first time on a major WWF show, only 4 minutes long, but a preview of what will come in the future. I won't post all of the Meltzer ratings, why too many matches, to list, so I'll only post the lowest two and the highest two. Minus five for JYD Moondog Spa, and Moondog, and poor Moondog, poor Spotty, as a gorilla would say. Minus five and a dud. He gives Steamboat Davy Boy 3.75 and 4 stars for Savage and Dynamite.
Wow. That's a pretty high rating from Dave.
Yeah, it is.
I guess at the time, he wasn't a big WWF fan, Dave Meltzer, in the 80s, so to him this was probably like a gold mine, this match. So, all right, Neil Trauma, you mean we have to wait a whole extra week for our Rumble 1996? What am I going to do with myself? You're going to listen to the Wrestling Classic, my friend.
Exactly. The intern in Jack Tunney's Toronto office, Savazio. Oh, not a long one. Wow, this was before I was born, like 2 years from... But my dad watched with my uncles, and my dad liked the Hogan Piper match. So I guess Savazio wasn't there. Maybe you have to ask his uncle if his dad said, "Who's that blonde asshole wrestling Piper?" Well, he's munching on a bag of Lay's. He finishes with, "But I watched on YouTube, Adrian Adonis looks so unhealthy at this point, but I consider this a house show, not a pay-per-view, but I respect it."
He respects it. Love it.
He respects it.
Chris Knights. Much like going back to review the show, the Wrestling Classic is for completists only. A couple of good matches, but far outweighed by the bad. Too many matches given no time. If my request for the show earlier this year in any way influenced your decision to go back and review the show, I apologize. Well, Chris, we just aim to please the fans. And honestly, it didn't take us long to watch or write it. And it was a good nostalgia trip for us because we've been out of the, 80s, early 90s loop for a while in both our podcast and written review. So
right,
it was fun to go back and
no, it was nice to go back. It was a good. It was only a couple hours. It wasn't like, didn't take up too much time. So Dave Hall, a show with one purpose, to put over the Macho Man. Problem is there are too many tag team and lower card guys in the tournament. At least JYD was still a big enough name to make the victory in the final mean something. And even though the feud is basically over, Hogan and Piper still can't have a clean finish. But at least Savage proves to be the king of tournaments, something that will be shown again in 2.5 years. Do people actually think Savage won this tournament?
It seems like it, yeah. Well, I honestly did for a long time, too. Or I'd forget that he didn't, because he's even on the cover, isn't he, of the tape? Or is JYD on the cover?
My tape's a dub, so I've never actually seen the cover of the tape.
I can't remember. Maybe they both are.
I'll have to check. You do the next couple comments, and I'll check Coffin. I'll check Graham to see if he's got a picture of it.
Hang on one sec. Because I'm already there. Oh, actually, it's Hogan and Piper. Oh, the back is Savage and JYD. That's what I was thinking of.
Oh, is that what it was? Oh, okay.
Yeah. I don't know. Like I said, I've only seen it once, so... I think that was always my memory because I think Savage was just more impressive. So, all right, Mr. Pfaff. Randy Savage should have won in the finals. No disrespect for the Junkyard Dog.
Okay. Let's see. I have to fix my... Oh, my. Shoots himself. Michael Vincent. Savage should have won it all. Thanks for reviewing it. I'm happy Spotty won against that drunk Terry Funk. Did Funk versus Spot ever happen again?
We'll let someone else look that up for you.
Yeah, I seriously doubt it. But
Wade Ferrari. Didn't really care for the show too much. Having a one-night tournament with 16 guys wasn't a good idea, as it just led to a bunch of bad matches that were all short and rushed, which is too bad, as most of the guys in it were pretty good and capable of putting on much better matches. JYD winning is a waste. I really don't get why they couldn't have just let Savage win, as he was clearly the guy they had the most plans for. While watching this again, I was really impressed by Adrian Adonis. The DDT counter was pretty cool, as was the sharpshooter he busted out in the second match. Hogan and Piper was about what you would expect. While they were both great characters who could cut promos, both were pretty average as far as in-ring work goes.
Okay. Rob King. not much to say about the Wrestling Classic. In-ring was pretty bland. You can't give anything higher than 3 stars, and not one match goes more than 10 minutes. Most of what I remember is not related to the in-ring work. I remember the ring not having real turnbuckles, and I remember the fan... yeah, it had, like, the boxing turnbuckles.
Yes.
And I remember the fan getting a new car.
Yeah, we didn't get to see that segment. It was cut out on your copy, but I guess on 24/7, when they aired it, they inserted it back in.
Oh, did they? Okay. Yeah. But my favorite part is at the start when Jack Tunney comes on and explains that to move on to the tournament, you have to win your match. Well, no shit, Sherlock. Safazio should have run the Toronto office.
All right, Ashley Cruz, who I saw kissing Scott Keith's ass on Facebook earlier tonight. The first real WWF pay-per-view is a mess. A classic it is not. Definitely old school. Numerous matches ending via countout, DQ, and even a ref stoppage. What is this, mid-90s WCW? I really think Piper should have won the belt here. It would have whipped the fans into a frenzy for a WrestleMania 2 rematch easily. I never thought of that. Do you think they should have done that?
It's not a bad idea, and I tell you something. Put him in... You know, a lot of people think that the other option for Vince was Hogan and Nikolai Volkoff. Nikita Koloff in
option.
The cage. But yeah, of course. And Nikita Koloff. But could you imagine Hogan Piper in a cage?
Yeah, it would have been off the charts.
It would have been freaking ridiculous.
The only thing I think of is those that they really wanted Hogan to have a, you know, this was still during the time of long face title reigns. You know, this is pretty much one of the last. Well, actually, no, it wouldn't be one of the last ones. But that was still the formula here. So I think they were trying to have him meet that Bob Backlund-esque reign with a long, you know, 3 or 4 year reign. So I'm guessing that's why they didn't take the belt off. I mean, he was such a cash cow here. Yeah, they could have, you know, cashed in, but they wanted WrestleMania 2 to succeed. But like I said, that wasn't their goal for building. You know, they were using WrestleMania to get the house shows going. So Hogan was the draw in the house shows, not Piper, and that's what they wanted to do.
If this was like the mid-90s.
Right, that would have been a good idea.
Definitely, they would have done that. Yeah, absolutely. Jay Arsenio D'Amato. Adrian Adonis was a voluptuous C-cup. Lovely. He would graduate to double Ds by WrestleMania 3. Jesse had one of his top 5 all-time performances in color. I agree. We both agree. He helped Macho Man's rise to a main eventer. I loved how he was dying for Santana and Orndorff to turn on each other. Terry Funk put on a Hall of Fame performance without wrestling an actual match with the tobacco spit on the camera and getting punked by Moondog Spot. Pay-per-view was still in its infancy, so they avoided some big feud matches like JYD Funk that played on the house show circuit. Did Davey Boy really injure his yam bag? Piper manages to be the only one that never had to lay down for Hogan. Not a classic, but typical 80s entertainment. We said that I think it was planned that way.
Yeah,
that,
so that I guess so. I haven't seen Anthony either way officially. So
yeah, I haven't either. So, right, so it probably was built that way.
Yep, and that wraps up our trip back to 1985 with the Wrestling Classic. We hope you enjoyed this little detour on our road through the Vintage Vault. And of course, you know, this will be your weekend entertainment. We will be back next week for headlines. We're going to have our friend Jay Hinchey on with us towards the end of the show. He's going to Raw this week. He's going to give us a live recap of that. And then we will give you our WrestleMania prediction. So we're going to structure this headlines probably a little bit differently. We're going to do the first half. We'll probably just kind of skim through Raw since Jay's going to be giving us more of a live perspective anyway. So we'll do that. We'll talk about Raw briefly. We'll read through some news. And then the second half is going to mainly be WrestleMania prediction before Jay comes on. So that's going to be that there. And then later in the week, we're hoping to be back with Royal Rumble 1996. As of now, that's the plan. We will keep you all abreast of that situation.
Yes.
Other than that, visit us, please, at bigelow34.proboards.com if you want to read this review, as you just heard. Visit us on Facebook at The Place to Be Podcast, at Twitter, Place Number 2 B Podcast. You can email us, theplacetobepodcast@gmail.com. And, of course, on Stitcher Radio app. You can download that on your iPad, your iPhone, smartphone, website, wherever you want to do. Listen to us there. Listen to us on Facebook. Listen to us on Podbean. We're all around the world for you.
Yes.
Here, talking wrestling. For your wrestling driven needs.
That's right. And we're still here. And the Bambina didn't, you weren't summoned by the Queen and the Princess. There you go.
No, she's been good tonight, thankfully. So.
Excellent.
All right, that's it. Let's wrap things up. We will be back next week. And of course, April 12th, Gary Michael Capetta. Please bring us your questions that are still pinned on the top of the page. So check
He's
that
out. He's asking for them, folks. He's
yes,
asking.
Yes, he wants your questions. So yes. We already get some good ones at the bank, so it's good. So that's it. Have a good weekend. We'll talk to you next week as we finish up the road to WrestleMania 28. Talk to you later.
Good night to Bambina.
Now just throw your hand. hands in the motherfucking air and wave the motherfuckers like you just don't care. Yeah, roll up the dank and pour the drink and watch your stank.
Why?
Cause doggies on the gang. My bank rolls on swole. My shit's on hit legit. Now I'm on parole. Stroke. Put the dog pound right behind me and up in your bitch is where you might find me playing that G-Bang. She want the nigga with the biggest nuts. Then guess what? He is I and I am him. Slim with the tilted brim. What's my motherfucking name?